I'm reading part of this 1935 training letter newspaper, and I did translate the entire newspaper. So if you don't want to listen to me, you can skip ahead towards the end, and you will see on the left will be the German original, and the right will be the Google image translation in English. So you can pause it and just read it. It is a fantastic newspaper. So much info in here. And I'll try to remember to include the PDF link as well. So on the right there, they're quoting Dietrich Eckart. And it says, "O Lord in heaven, they all cling to you, friends and enemies, in burning need, that your hand may fall on the guilty one who threatens their hearth and homeland. Childlike faith, as if only your will prevailed when you call out your thunderous word. High above you in eternal silence stands the gel that you yourself created. Nothing is completed and nothing is begun without the iron," I'm not sure what that word should be, "muck, mask, I don't know, of this duty. Only obeying him do the suns circle, the seas rage, and the light wander. Hearts and hands, brains and blood, from generation to generation are subject to him, flashing swords and blazing fires, that which says order and justice. Father in heaven, in life and death, we stand before you. Answer now, is there another people that serves the noble commandment more honestly than we Germans do?" And I'm reading a little more from Eckhart. It says, "Of eternal birth" was the title of the article. "May God help us to lean upon God so much that he himself desires to be born in us. Amen. Yes, I maintain that all the prayers and all the good works that man may perform in this time have as little effect on God's grace as if there were none at all. And God will therefore be no more lenient and favorable toward man than if he had never performed a prayer or a good work toward him. You could then say, I hear that all prayer and all good works are lost since God does not accept them, that one could determine him with them. And yet one claims that God does not want to be asked for anything. Here you must pay attention and understand me correctly, if you want to. With a first eternal glance, if we are to accept a first glance, God saw all things as they saw in the same glance when and how he, I guess, I think maybe that should be created creatures. He also saw the smallest prayer and good work that somehow someone would perform and saw which prayer and what devotion he will hear. He expects that you will call upon him urgently tomorrow and ask earnestly. And God will not hear this call in prayer tomorrow, but he has heard it in all eternity before you became human. But if your prayer is not honest and without earnestness, God will not ask you to do it now. He has already asked you to do it in all eternity. Thus, God has seen everything with his first eternal glance. Nothing happens on occasion. But everything is already done in advance. Thus, God always stands in his immovable seclusion, and yet people's prayer and good works are not lost because of this. So, my note is he's saying here that obviously God created everything and everything already existed. We're just kind of like the way I view it is God wrote the book, right? He's the author. We are just playing it out. So, is that what Eckhart is saying here? So anyway, on the right there, it says, "Now, whoever wants to find enlightenment and insight into all truth should wait and pay attention to this birth within him, because then all his powers and all his external man will be enlightened. Therefore, when a person becomes aware that the spirit of God is not working in him and that his inner man has rather been abandoned by God, then it is all too necessary that the external man should be active in pious activities, especially in those that are the most effective and beneficial for him. Not, however, to gain some credit for himself, but to honor the truth so that he is not distracted and misled by the tangible, but rather holds close to God so that he will find him close by when he wants to return to do his work in the soul and does not have to look for him from afar. If, on the other hand, a person finds himself inclined to true inwardness, even if he boldly lets everything external fall away, even if they were activities to which you had bound yourself by vows from which neither the Pope nor the bishop could release you. For the vows that someone makes to God cannot be taken away from him. They are just as much obligations to God. You should have an elevated spirit, not a drooping one, a burning spirit in which an untroubled, silent stillness prevails. You do not need to tell God what you need or desire. He knows everything in advance. But when you pray, Christ said to his disciples, you should not use many words in your prayer like the Pharisees. God never reveals himself completely in this life, so that it would not be nothing compared to what he really is. So this article, just reading a few paragraphs of it, Be of Good Will. And it's by, I don't know, F.H. Maurice, Training and Contemporary Issues. Peace to those who are of good will. Frisian distress, a German confession. If Christ came today, freedom, we believe, tactics and faith of thought, not without discipline. This isn't really complete sentences here. So graves as anchors to the future. Men of the dead lives. Rehabilitation of business ethics. 2 years of joy. Victory before the battle. This is all, I think, what he's going to talk about in his thing, in his write-up. So, my bad. The church has allowed the literal part of the second of the time-honored message of peace to disappear. In the Christmas weeks of the past two decades, these few words could have answered the doubts that kept cropping up for countless people, which arose from the harsh conflict that emerged in a bloody and bitter way between the message and the present. Our generation has had to learn all too clearly that earthly peace depends on a decisive extent on the more or less goodwill of evil neighbors. Our own goodwill for peace can, however, also have a decisive influence on the unpeaceful desires of others. After all, each of us who has been of goodwill, and thus ultimately the overwhelming majority of the entire people, has made the German community of will the strongest guarantor of peace of our time by putting our personal will and opinion behind the will of the Führer. The fundamental nature of our relationship to the unique personality from the beginning of our era was expressed by Dr. Goebbels almost 10 years ago in the all-telling question, if Christ were to return today, would he chase us or his pliant servants out of his temple? And my note, obviously, they weren't really his servants, right? They were liars and deceivers. And note, Goebbels is also talking about Christ. He doesn't say, oh, Christ isn't real and the Bible's not real. He's talking about Christ because Goebbels was Christian. So anyway, continuing, the essence of our faith needs the clear, simple, and natural. The founder of Christianity, right, Christ, stood in Nain, a village in Galilee. The land heavily attacked by Judaism, or by Jews, was his home. There is therefore nothing forced about combining his birthday, right, Christ's birthday celebration, with the old holy nights of the winter solstice. At my note, the Bible says we shouldn't practice practice pagan holidays. So he may be incorrect here, but, you know, it is what it is. So his life and the intent was good. Their intent was good. So his life and his teachings, which showed God as a spirit and which was a continuous struggle, is not contrary to nature and alien to the earth. Such futures were only added in later times. Mistletoe and Christmas rose, solstice fire and tree of life, are no more alien to each other than the swastika and the Christian cross. So, very interesting that he said that. And I think that part is true. So, right? They are no more alien to each other than the swastika and the Christian cross. The evergreen tree in old German homes, which remains the same in snow and summer sun, with the lights of a longing that strives from the dark into the light, is a meaningful symbol between the two crosses. But it is not the cross and not the crucifix that concerns us, but the crucified one who, even in his readings, sorry, I didn't continue reading there. So I'm skipping over or moving forward over to the right there. It says, the Reichsfuhrer SS quoted from a booklet entitled 50 Questions and Answers for the SS Man. The second question, do you believe in a God? The answer, yes, I believe in a Lord God. The third question, what do you think of a person who does not believe in a God? The answer, I think he is arrogant, megalomaniac, and stupid. He is not suitable for us, right? Suitable for the SS. What is expressed in these seats as a confession to the Führer's Black Corps, right, the SS, and was first presented to the men of the German soil in the town, in the old town on the Harz, applies no less to every National Socialist. A divinely direct religious dignity lives on as a longing of the best in the formations of the movement. The unity of God and the world makes the people our highest task, a gift to God. Service to the people is the practical form of love for our neighbor and is therefore worship for us. And to use the words of the movement's dead preacher, Hans Schemm, where people and God are torn apart, there are criminals and a crime is committed. No one can do National Socialism a greater injustice than those who accuse it of godlessness. No one is further removed from National Socialism than those who blaspheme the belief in God. It has nothing to do with tactics if the party avoided talking about religious matters in the movement and thus the party branches in religious matters. Even with regard to the churches, Reich Minister Kerl said, quote, the Führer principle is not for the church. It is a political principle, unquote. Personal faith has not been placed under the authoritarian influence of the party. This is a fundamental principle that has nothing to do with our attitudes to the external manifestations of individual denominations. So that's interesting on the, it's one that they're connecting National Socialism and obviously Christianity and God, right? Right, no one is further removed from National Socialism than those who blaspheme the belief in God. And of course, who back then, most of the people who did that were who? The Jews, the Marxists, the Bolsheviks, the Freethinkers, right? They were all subversive. Nowadays, of course, lots of people have been, unfortunately, have had their minds perverted by them into rejecting God and blaspheming God, so... and it's interesting what they say there about the Führer principle, because a lot of people I've heard claim that, oh, the Führer principle, everything, you know, had to be according to whatever he decreed. But obviously that isn't true. And in the national organ, the official organ of the National Socialist Party is literally telling you that right here. So continuing, the new Reich is fulfilling the will of its dead, for we are learning these days from detail and my note, that's, I think, those who died fighting for the new Reich. For we are learning these days from detailed investigations that the German national Christmas is slowly finding fuller cradles again. While all European countries except Ireland are showing a further decline in the birth rate for 1934, the German birth rate has risen again to 18 per 1,000 inhabitants. However, despite this leading position in Europe, it is still not the number necessary to maintain our national strength. With 11.2 marriages per 1,000 inhabitants, or an increase from 516,000 in 1932 to 739,000 in 1934, our people are today far ahead of the rest of Europe. But where in the world has one of the wealthiest peoples paid anywhere near such generous practical recognition to the sanctity of birth as our Reich has done in its marriage laws? From August 1933, not 53, to June 1935, a total of 440,826 marriage loans totaling around 270 million Reichsmarks were paid out. That's crazy. And up to that point, no less than half of these, namely 220,844 repayment waivers for live-born children had been granted. In future, the Reich will grant 15 to 20,000 marriage loans per month. In addition, 7,500 families with six children each will receive 400 Reichsmarks as a child benefit. 20 million Reichsmarks will be distributed for this purpose by Christmas. In exactly the same way, Germany was able to reduce its unemployment rate from 5.1%, 5.1 million to 1.71 million, i.e. by 3.4 million or 66% between October 1st, 1932 and October 1st, 1935. In the same period, the rest of the world was only able to put 2.1 million or a full 10% of people into work. And this too was only possible with a huge amount of currency devaluation maneuvers, credit expansion, quotas, etc. In America, one in every 10 Americans is unemployed, worse than in the worst times of the system here. Germany has only 25 unemployed people per 1,000 people and is thus only in 10th place in terms of world unemployment, far behind the United States, England, Holland, Austria, and the Czech Republic and other countries. Natural fluctuations, which can never be completely eliminated, are systematically counteracted. These figures are a good news of the deed. Just as gratifying is the recently established fact that the notorious systematic mistake of healthy bankruptcy has been successfully overcome. Never during the post-war period have the bankruptcy figures been as low as in the last 2 years. The official party correspondence can rightly state, quote, "The impression that the sharp decline in the number of bankruptcies is mainly due to the moral influence of the new state on the economy is contradicted by a more detailed analysis of the collapse." Thus, positive Christianity and National Socialism creates a pleasure for the people. Just another remark that he had in this article. So that's it for that article. Now they start talking about the swastika. So you can go skip ahead and read the entire article. It was long. I'm just reading a little bit and showing a few pictures. I agree with all of the historical info provided in the article. I don't agree with the, I don't know what the word is. I guess the timeline of how they say the swastika formed or moved. I think it's reversed. They claim it started in Nordic countries thousands of years ago and then migrated down east, south, and west from there. And that's why it ended up everywhere. I don't agree with that. In my opinion, from what I've researched, it started where we started in the Middle East and then was brought with us all throughout the world and into Europe, you know, in ancient times. So, but regardless, the article is incredibly interesting with so much historical fact and important stuff. So anyway, so top left, it says, "The Reich citizenship laws are intended to ensure that the line of succession thus begun will find more pronounced conditions for the continuation of this policy of internal peace in each coming generation. The racial legislation, which received the implementing provisions on November 15th, is one of the most important components of the final health and welfare of the people. The Jews themselves have subjected themselves to far harsher regulations in their legislation. The opponents of our hereditary health care must listen to the Belgian Jesuit Fallon in the American Journal Eugenics in New York, 1923. And he wrote on page 45, "The original purpose of marriage is the reproduction of the human race. That is to say, the creation of human beings and not of changelings and degenerates," right? Don't race mess, basically what he's saying. Breed healthy. So, clear laws, again, bind us to God-given facts and also ensure that the Jews, as long as he is of goodwill, a tolerable relationship. As the Fuhrer said in Nuremberg and Gauleiter Stryker took upon the Sportoplast in Berlin with the statement that if the Jews kept these laws, no hair on their heads would be harmed, right? Doesn't that contradict the official story that we're told today? So let's read that again. So here, these are pictures that are from the article on the history of the swastika. And on the top middle there, it shows two pictures from one from 1916, World War I, soldiers had the swastika used in whatever unit that was. And then on the right, some of the Free Corps used the swastika. And that's pretty amazing. I had never heard that before. On the bottom middle, it shows a swastika from the Scythians from 500 BC, which is interesting because from that area is from what I read, if you read Alan Wilson and a whole bunch of other historians, I think Sharon Turner and others, that is the area where the Israelites migrated up from through the Caucasus Mountains, hence we became known as Caucasians, up through Italy and other places, through Turkey, etc., up into Europe. And of course, well before 500 BC as well. So, but that little swastika, the colored one in the middle there, so the Germans mentioned that in this article that the Americans' military unit, the 45th Infantry Division, had used a swastika as well, which is crazy. I had no idea. And you know what? That's true. The 45th Infantry Division used that symbol, a swastika, in World War I, and that was their symbol, I believe, until 1939. So, yeah. Now, over on the right is a symbol. It's crosses and swastikas and a tree of life, and it says Ireland's National Shrine, St. Patrick's Shrine, and it says it has a cross, swastika, and this tree of life on it, which is. Well, the cross and the tree of life is all biblical, and I believe the swastika, which is a bent cross, is biblical as well. So, very interesting. So, this I think was one of the best articles in here. Again, I'm reading some of it. You can fast forward and pause and read all of it. I think it's like 10 pages long. There was a lot to it. And again, I agree with most of it, or almost all of it. I just don't agree with the one thing that Arno gets wrong, in my opinion, is he seems to believe that the Old Testament may be talking about Jews, which is not true at all. So I think that's just one error, but like everything else in this article, I think is amazing and truthful and accurate. So definitely well worth reading. So anyway, he wrote, "It is time to put an end to the myth that has been peddled to this day that in the past the Jews were both farmers and cattle breeders. This is also a historical construction that has long been refuted by the facts. The quote unquote urban race, which populated the stone buildings of antiquity and the present because of its very special livelihood, usury, was never able to survive directly from a region like all other peoples, but only through the exploitation of their fellow human beings. This is the decisive difference from all other races, peoples, and tribes." And my note, I just want to interject here. Notice what he says there. He said he wants to end the myth that the Jews were farmers and cattle breeders. And they weren't, right? And the Bible states that his enemies, God's enemies, our enemies, would be cursed on the earth and cursed from the soil, that they wouldn't be farmers. But it says that his people would be farmers and till the soil and whatnot, right? So if Arno is saying that the Jews are not farmers, but God and the Bible are saying that his people are, well, then clearly they're not the same people. And it proves that the Jews are not the people of the Bible, or one of a million different proofs. But I just wanted to point that out. So, anyway, continuing on, underneath that says, noted another Jewish historian, George Caro, in his book History of the Jews, without, however, looking closely at the first quoted person, quote, I don't know why I included that. Anyway, so here's a quote from the Jew Kaeserling. I think he was Jewish. And am I misreading this? Well, whatever, I'm going to continue. Sorry. Usury found its nourishment in the needs of the people. Unquote. All right, so that I believe was George Caro. The most devastating statement ever made by a Jewish historian and rabbi, quote, "The interest charged by Jews, we will not deny it, seems to have reached an excessive level. Everything was given as collateral. The farmer gave his plow, the knight his castle, the king his jewelry, the bishop his ring," added Kaeserling. His remarks, the Jews in Navarre. So I think Caetherling wrote that book and wrote that remark in the book, The Jews of Navarre. Another error consciously maintained by Jewry as a whole must be corrected. It was not the population living in each country that created the ghetto, but the Jews themselves, in order not to associate with the rest of the people, whom Jewry saw as created solely to serve its own proper exploitation. It isolated, right, the Jews isolated itself in arrogant contempt. It itself, right, the Jews created the ghetto with its own administration based on Jewish teaching, right, from the Talmud, not the Bible, which we still find in the Kahal, the Jewish community administrations in former Russia. It was only much later in the so-called late Middle Ages when the individual host peoples had found sufficient opportunity to study the strange earning habits of their host colonies, right, the Jews, more closely from their own experience, that the compulsory ghetto arose. So over on the right, fast forwarding, the path of Judaism to the French Revolution, the interactions between the Jews and their host peoples, regardless of the time, the general conditions and the intellectual mood, followed a course that was repeated everywhere with only minor deviations until the French Revolution, and which could be described as follows. One, based on certain reports from their scouts, the Jews immigrate to a country or are victoriously advanced by a people. The people meet the Jews with a certain curiosity. Skipping ahead, there is absolutely no reason to accuse the, so this is a quote by a Jew right here. There is absolutely no reason to accuse the Christians of having been hostile towards the Jews beforehand or of wanting to oppress them because of their religion. On the contrary, the Christians had reason to complain about the excessive privileges. Says the pro-Jewish scholar, C.F. Herman. Sorry, he was not Jewish. So I take that back. Says the pro-Jewish scholar, C.F. Herman, in his book, The Historical World Position of the Jews. About the activities of the Jews in Spain, for example, there the movable wealth of the country was entirely in their hands, in the Jews' hands. Land ownership increasingly came into the hands through usury and the purchase of indebted properties, right? Which mean mortgaged properties, right? Which now they have the whole world mortgaged. Anyway, continuing. Apart from the Secretary of State and the Minister of Finance, all officials who had to do with taxes and financial matters were Jews, right, in Spain. Through usury, almost all of Aragon was mortgaged to them. In the city, they formed the majority of the wealthy population. Even the princes are no longer able to resist the increasing unrest, right, caused by usury. Giving in to the justified desire for self-defense and tempted by the rich booty that beckons them, they decide on the general expulsion of the Jews. This schematic presentation of the interrelations focuses on Spain, Portugal, France, and England. As is well known, the Jews were expelled from Spain in 1492. Despite their numerical strength, they did not resort to arms when their means of bribery failed. Incidentally, a major error can be refuted here, the dissemination of which is extremely dear to Judaism. The claim that the expulsion of the Jews marked the beginning of the decline of Spain. The opposite is true. In 1492, with the discovery of America by Columbus, the decline of Spain began. Well, it says there, but then it says on top, Spain's rise to power, world power, I think should say began. So I think it's a mistranslation. I think it's supposed to say Spain's rise to world power began. A decline that began under Philip II was due to entirely different factors, which robbed Spain of its best minds and at the same time drained it of a stream of blood that it could no longer bear. The Jews had to leave France for good under Philip V, but they were accepted into the neighboring duchies of Burgundy and Flanders, Brabant, from where they soon began to flow back. Edward V of England expelled them from England in 1290, and they were not allowed to enter England again openly until Cromwell, whom they supported with sums of money, although they may have been no lack of secret Jews in England in the meantime, which, my note, that would be something interesting to study and what we could find out about that. Anyway, continuing, but they did not play the highly significant role played by the Marranos in Spain, which was still evident in the recent revolution of 1931, right? Which was the Spanish Revolution, where the Jew Bolsheviks invaded Spain in 1931. Then you had Franco come in and save the nation, right? So he's saying that basically crypto, right? Crypto Jews played a role in that. But anyway, continuing, but the fatal combination of the religious ideas of the Bible-loving and literal-believing Puritans with the idea of the quote-unquote chosen people was enough to allow their descendants back into the country for ethical reasons to the detriment of the English host population. So there, I guess he's saying the note he has chosen people in quotes, right? Because I think he may know that's not true. They're not the people of the Bible. And possibly, I'm not sure, but it's interesting he put that in quotes. And he's saying that the Puritans, the Christians, who were possibly pure white Aryan Christians, were deceived by this story that the Jews were chosen. And or is he saying that is one of the reasons why the English accepted the Jews back into England? You know, maybe. Not sure, but I mean, it makes sense. So anyway, continuing on the right. For Judaism always knew that separation from its host peoples meant its downfall, since it could not, like the other peoples, live alone, right? Because they're parasitical. Continuing, but the Jews in turn took advantage of the self-defense measures of the exploited populations of the most varied racial groups and regions to break out into loud cries about alleged persecution of the Jews and to circulate and maintain the fairy tale of the poor and oppressed children of Israel. Excuse me, by concealing or distorting the true causes, right? I've done other videos on this from Poland, Russia, Romania, etc. in the news where people talked about either reporters or actual ambassadors or other political people spoke about the real reasons the Jews are being persecuted and not the nonsense that we're told. So anyway, on the right there, it says after the French Revolution, until the French Revolution, the activities of the Jews within their individual host nations were still relatively easy to trace. With the help of the loot they had acquired, they were very soon in a position to exert a decisive influence on the most important institutions and people, to thwart measures or to prepare them in their own interests that would further their effectiveness without this influence being in any way conspicuous to the outside world. For these reasons, it is not possible to work with the simple numerical ratio of Jews to the rest of the population, as is always deliberately done by the Jews in order to conceal these facts. For 300,000 Jews in quote-unquote high positions in the capital of a country who controlled the economic life of their host people were and are in a position to influence the fate of that country more sustainably than perhaps the remaining 29 million scattered inhabitants, especially after democratization brought money into its unlimited power. So it's interesting, right? The Jews, so what he's saying there is the Jews claim, oh, well, we're such a tiny minority. We don't control anything because there's so many more of you. But he's saying that's not true. When all the Jews control the mechanisms of the government or finance or whatever in a country, then they control the entire country. It does not matter how many other people are in the country. And we see that today, that's true. Anyway, continuing, it says, however, the influence exerted by the Jews in intellectual terms should not be underestimated, since it resulted in a very profound change in the physical, legal, and economic conception of their host peoples, right? So he's saying, I believe he's saying there, that their influence, right, when they controlled everything, changed the physical, legal, and economic conception of their host peoples, right? So physical, maybe because it made them poorer and weaker, or maybe because they introduced foreigners, or maybe because they bred with the host nation, right? So the host nation is basically downbreeding and making themselves sicker and weaker and dumber. So anyway, so continuing, it says, as Mommsen correctly described the Jews in his youth as the, quote, ferment of decomposition, unquote, right? It backs up what I just said there. Anyway, continuing, a continuous fluid of disintegration flowed from them into all areas of the life of their host peoples. The firmly established life orders, which correspond to the essential structure of their host peoples, hinder the Jews in their activity, which is why they, the Jews, act as destroyers of all organic barriers. The egalitarianism, which is fraudulent, found its champions in them, right, in Jews, because the larger a general structuralist swamp, the more advantageous it is for them, right? Which we see all over the world today, especially white nations now. Gradually, the entire social life of those peoples came under Jewish influence. There was no area in which they did not rule, in which they did not prescribe the laws of action and thought, or at least tried to prescribe them, beginning with fashion, which is interesting that he mentioned fashion here back hundreds of years ago, continuing with intellectual and artistic creation, and ending with political leadership and social development. They were the masters of the land. They also felt like such and looked down with contempt on the natives who had been dispossessed in their own territory by Jewish machinations cloaked in a veneer of law. What a true statement there, because that is everywhere today in our world. Continuing, if the end of the liberal era, which, well, I'll get to that. If the end of the liberal era, and especially the 19th century, deserves the name that has so far been sought in vain, then it can rightly be called the Jewish century. That is true. What a statement. For it can rightly be called the Jewish century, for never before has the world been so clearly under Jewish rule, albeit still disguised to the outside world, as at the beginning of the 20th century. There was no institution in public life in which Jews were not represented, or which they did not influence through many invisible threads. No major event was behind which there were not Jewish forces, in one sense or another, who were able to exploit all changes to their advantage. In 1910, Moira Goldstein wrote, quote, "Suddenly, Jews are in all positions from which they are not forcibly kept away. It increasingly seems as if German cultural life is about to pass into Jewish hands. We Jews are managing the intellectual life of a people who deny us the right and ability to do so," unquote. The world was Judaized. Quote, "We have eaten our way into the peoples, the races, corrupted them, broken their strengths, made everything brittle and rotten. In fact, today, everything is Judaized. Our spirit can no longer be eradicated," unquote. And that was from the Jew Munzer, who openly admitted that. But that was not enough for Judaism. In accordance with their teachings and promises, right, which is from the Talmud, not the Bible, they continue to strive for ultimate supremacy. The Great War was, as one of their most important leaders, Nordah Sudfeld, has admitted, only one rung on this ladder. The aim was to use the world conflagration, right, World War I, to which they had contributed decisively, right, the Jews contributed to causing that, albeit more behind the scenes, to eliminate the national governments that still offered resistance to them, and if possible, to destroy the monarchist government systems that had emerged from historical development, and to see in their place even more compliant ones. The Jews called this democratization. The most noble, one must understand the full infamy of this turn of phrase or use of phrase. The most noble enemy war aim, the democratization of Germany, will be realized because we will not displace the sons of well, I was supposed to say Yahweh, but they're not. They're the sons of Satan. They are not of God, wrote Prince Lichowski, the former German ambassador in London, who was unfortunately not brought to justice for high treason at the time during the war. So, that's interesting. So anyway, on the right, it says, the Jews' plan seemed to be working. Imperial Russia, which they hated, collapsed under the onslaught of the German armies. And from beneath its ruins rose the blood-red flag of Bolshevism, greeted joyfully by world Jewry. The bloodiest reign of terror intended for all peoples under Jewish leadership had come to fruition in one country, right, Russia. Then the German homeland succumbed to the incessant maneuvers of undermining. Quote, "We will not recall the state that was," unquote, the Jew Frankfurter Zeitung happily entices. Quote, "The powers that undermined it from within have done a thorough and, by all accounts, lasting job," unquote, says the Jewish Professor raged. But this joy came a little too soon, as the attempts to exploit the German people went too far. Their resistance awoke. Primal forces came to life again, which longed for a new form of the Judaism, with its aim of destroying a strong, organically unbearable form of life in the non-Jewish world. As the Jew Blumfield dared to proclaim in Berlin in 1920, Judaism is further away than ever from a victory over those forces. At least in Germany, which recognizes its opponents, right, the Jews, and knows that not carrying on this struggle, despite other possible successes, means national suicide. All right, so on the top left, already in the time of Louis XIV, the Jews in France had achieved a dangerous influence at his court, in his government, as army suppliers, tax farmers, and collectors. They were at the back of all those secret conspiracies of Freemasonry and humanitarian brotherhoods, from whose bosom the slogan of equality, freedom, and fraternity grew. Not for nothing did these purely pacifist clans working towards world brotherhood take and continue to take their Kabbalistic customs from synagogue service, right? That's where their orders come from the rabbis and the synagogues. And where do they get their orders? I believe from Satan himself. Well, from the Talmud and Satan himself. And to be continuing, if one ignores all the empty slogans of the French Revolution, the decisive Trojan horse is the demolition of the ghetto, or the so-called emancipation of the Jews. A ruling aristocracy lost its power to the holders of money, the Jews, who grabbed it by a thousand tricks and ruses. And then on, the real rise of Judaism began, for which its growing booty made it increasingly easier to expand its power. It is not for nothing that Judaism itself has stated that the revolution is the star of Jews. It's not the star of Judah. It's not a thing. So, continuing, they claim to be descendants of a... So here, he's making an interesting note here. They, the Jews, claim to be descendants of a fragmentary desert tribe from which they possibly borrowed their name, or even descendants of the inhabitants of a region in the country. Like I said, I don't know what this guy thinks. I think he believes they are the people of the Bible. But right there in that statement, he is questioning it, right? Because he's saying they're claiming that. It doesn't mean history proves that, which it doesn't, because the Jews are not from the tribe of Israel, Jacob, Abraham, Adam, or anything. They are from Satan. So, and that is critical to understand in order to understand what's happening in the world and who they are, who we are, and why they hate us. So it's not just for no reason that they hate us. And it's deeper than they just hate us because we're different or better looking or whatever, you know, you want to come up with. So anyway, continuing, the most important men who have dealt with the Jewish belief in one God as expressed in the Bible have repeatedly expressed the view that Judaism as such, taken in its purity, contains no religious belief at all, right? So that's interesting, because the Jews, people claim the Jews believe in God, or if people believe that the Bible's there, they believe in God. But here is saying that in its purity, the Jews don't have a religious belief at all. They don't believe in God. They reject God. They're atheists, they're satanic, and they believe in Satan. Again and again, they have stressed that the abstract monotheism of Judaism is only an abstract materialism. That is interesting. That's Houston Stewart Chamberlain, apparently, I guess, said that. They don't believe in God, and that people have to understand this. So, and that their real God is money, as an expression of the purely material value of the whole world. Insofar as there are echoes or references to a so-called belief in the afterlife in Jewish teaching, they derive from borrowings from the most diverse peoples of whom Judaism came into contact in ancient times. Whether they go back to the Dolmen Builders of Palestine or were adopted from the Babylonians, Amuru, Egyptians, Persians, or others. The parasitism of Judaism. Nature knows groups of living beings whose formation can only have taken place in a secondary way. These are the so-called parasites, and among their many different forms, the so-called species of parasites in particular, which even when associated with one another, feed on the social beings of their host, which of course, unlike in symbiosis, bear the soul damage. So anyway, he's obviously comparing Judaism to parasitism. Anyway, continuing on the right there, Sombart once wrote in his study on the Jews and economic life, the extent to which continuous crossbreeding between human races already developed in different regions played a decisive role in triggering the still unexplained spontaneous changes in genetic makeup, which remain an open question. Then he says, this is irrelevant to the assessment of Judaism, right? So I think what he's maybe saying there is that Jews are just Jews, just who they are. The only decisive factor in its assessment is the conclusion that can be drawn from its way of life and its expression of life about its position in relation to other human races, peoples, and groups. For even if the study of man is disadvantaged in many respects compared to natural history, it does not have the advantage of being able to take into account intellectual products and the concept of life that they express, which in turn allows conclusions to be drawn about the nature of a particular community. If the historical facts coincide with the meaning of the views laid down by the same group, then all doubt is eliminated. The proof of social parasitism practiced by a human group has been provided, since its possibility cannot be denied from the outset. The world may at most argue about the manner in which it was created. The fact itself can no longer be denied. It is not for nothing that the Jews have been called sons of chaos. They have escaped the chaos of the Near East through legal. It didn't translate right on the right there. Anyway, I'll skip that and continue. The same can be said of the accumulation of various hereditary phenomena in Judaism, some of which could perhaps be interpreted as signs of degeneration and are also found in other peoples, although not with such frequency. Despite all this, something indefinably Jewish remains, which eludes direct determinism by means of a ruler, compasses, and all other methods, such as blood group research. The Jew also has his characteristic features, which are admittedly difficult to grasp anthropologically, says Feist. Gunther also emphasizes this. The process of racial formation has given rise to something Jewish. One must not only think of the hereditary processes, the laws of which have been researched, but also of the appearance of certain bloodlines known to animal breeders, in which, in a way that has not yet been sufficiently researched, the individual characteristics of the crossed races are no longer inherited independently of one another, but appear to be connected in such a way as, for example, a certain combination of features of the lower lip in the Habsburg family and chin. And also through such inheritance in bloodline, something Jewish must have spread among the Jewish people. Which, my note, that's how they were. The Bible says that we would know them by their countenance, right? Anyway, continuing, this typically Jewish element would be the typically parasitic element that is also possible among humans. Precisely because this secondary formation is subject to such narrow limits among the highly complex Homo sapiens, its detection in external appearance is all the more striking. In a physiological study of the race, Stigler reports, among other things, quote, psychological behavior is particularly typical in Jewish women. There is a striking frequency of a blurring of psychological femininity and the appearance of soul characteristics that are described as unfeminine. Above all, a retreat of specifically female instincts, female passivity, and the inhibitions of a psychomotor impulses typical of women, for example, the fear of public appearances, which explains the predominance of Jewish women among political agitators. This is very important in the cases of Jews. The ongoing effort to balance the social and professional differences between men and women while failing to recognize the importance of secondary sexual characteristics, which are instinctively maintained and promoted in normal people. So my note, that's pretty interesting what he's saying there, that I guess the female Jews are just inherently different from the Aryan females. Their instincts are different. And yeah, and so maybe that's why when people crossbreed, you're now confusing the two, and you may have people that maybe don't look Jewish that but have these unfeminine Jewish instincts. Maybe that's why the one of the reasons for I'm not sure, I'm just hypothetical here, why you have so much more homosexualness in society now, because the Jewish blood has been spread all over the place, and then women who should be feminine have absorbed this unfeminine Jewish blood and they act it out. Or obviously it makes it who they are, right? And they become unfeminine. And yeah, I don't know. It's interesting when you try to think about all this stuff. Anyway, continuing. For example, the Jewish traveler Solomon from Andalusia reported in the 9th century that on his journey in China, he found Jews in many large cities who also understood Hebrew. Of these colonies, however, only that of the Kaifengfu has survived the longest. So my note are these now, were these quote unquote Jews that we think of today, right? The sons of Satan that he found, or which probably by the 9th century, I bet that they were. Or were they descendants of actual white Aryans? Because the white Aryan Israelites had ruled over and civilized and you know, created empires that ruled over much of Asia, right? Their original Indian Empire that was actually a white Aryan Empire. And then if they mixed themselves with non-whites, they turned into what today we perceive as Indians. So anyway, in those regions too, Judaism must have become rich and influential, despite all the storms and upheaval that swept over it. In the kingdom of the Khazars, which existed in the 6th century AD until the 10th on the lower reaches of the Volga and the Don, we find the Jews as rich merchants who facilitated the trade of goods to Central Asia, India, and possibly as far as China. Their influence at the court of the Khazarichan was so powerful that the dynasty adopted Judaism, right? So I just want to point out there, Jews didn't originate in Khazaria. The Jews that really have nothing to do with Khazar or anything. It's literally nothing. What he's saying there is that the Khazar dynasty already existed. And then they allowed Jews to move in there. So Jews colonized or settled part of the kingdom, became super powerful. And then the idiot leader of the Khazars adopted their fake religion of Judaism, and I'm sure he and the people there bred with them. And so the people became racially Judaized. And then today, people, I guess, think that that means, oh, well, Khazar Jews, that's where Jews originated from. No, not at all. And I did a separate video on that. That idea is a Jewish idea that was created to distract from the truth that the Jews are of Satan, as the Bible states. So go watch that video. I think I included that in the video on titles something about rationalism. So anyway, continuing. As already mentioned above, these influences did not lead to a change in the nature of the Judaism of the Jews of the Athen. I don't know what that means. Since the special selection conditions, those are the poor translations, sorry. Application to Judaism remained in force and the breeding goal did not change. The areas that flourished in the West and the Tartar invasion from the East, I guess maybe, Asia, caused an expansion of Eastern Judaism into the Galatian and Polish regions. There, they were reached by an influx of Southern Jewish blood in the 14th and 15th centuries, which very quickly mixed with theirs. The first Jews came to Germany with the Roman legions, which they accompanied as money changers, traders, secondhand dealers, and suppliers. By the 3rd century, they were already quite numerous in the Alsace-Lorraine region and in the Rhine-Franconian region up to Trier and Cologne. From there, they advanced further as the importance of the north of Europe increased and that of the south decreased. In connection with the evacuation of the southern Jewish colonies that had recently emerged to Oldenburg, which was forced by the gradually awakening self-defense of the peoples, there was a gradual advance of the Eastern Jewish group from the 16th century onwards, which gradually moved westwards across the Hungarian lowlands, the Danube Valley, Maastricht, and Bohemia. In practice, Southern Jewry in Southern Europe, Central Europe, is now replaced by Eastern Jewry. Final note, from these observations on the special process of Judaism's emergence, its otherness and the resulting differences in worldview between Judaism and its host peoples, a number of conclusions flow which Germany has now drawn. The victory of National Socialism has brought about a synthesis between people and state. State authority in the hands of the people's leadership guarantees the development and promotion of the necessary requirements in all areas. In the most energetic pursuit of these goals, Jewish indifference in the creative and cultural sphere has been pushed back since the revolution, and the National Socialist laws promulgated in Nuremberg and the implementing regulations of November 15th have created a clear picture of the way in which Jews will continue to live together with the German people. This puts a stop to an unnerving disintegration and guarantees the free development and unfolding of the innate character of the German people. And so here is where the translation of the entire newspaper begins, and you can pause and read each page.